Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Don. I'm Dr. Don Motika, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare, and science in the news, and answers to your calls and emails about all of the above. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers, and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Last week, a caller wanted to talk about reversible contraception in males, and he got me started on doing the background research there and came up with a couple of things. There are a couple of interesting developments in the field of contraception over the last couple of years, and one of them is for women, a micro insert that's put into the fallopian tubes. Now, this is similar to a tubal ligation, and it is not considered a reversible procedure per se. It's a little insert, actually, that's made of polyester fiber with some metal and some stainless steel, and it's inserted through the vagina. It's sort of like over the hill and through the woods, through the vagina and through the cervix and into the uterus and out the tube. When it's in position and released, it expands a little bit, and after 3 months, the effectiveness of this is close to 99%, which is very good. Now, it's not easy to get in. About 5% of the time, the doctor's unable to get the inserts in on the first try, so 1 out of 20. Obviously, that's going to get better with practice. And it is available in our own community. So something to think about for women. It's called eSure. The caller was asking about injecting the vas deferens with drugs, and I wasn't able to find that particular thing. I think you may have been a little confused, but I did find a intravas device, and this is not yet FDA approved, but very far along in the pipeline. It's in phase 2 trials in China and phase 1 trials in the United States. And there's 2 different devices, but basically they're little plugs that are inserted into the sperm tube, the vas deferens. And this is done in a way very similar to the vasectomy procedure. The difference is that because these little plugs are solid and they're attached by a suture in the vas deferens, it's a reversible procedure. And therefore, theoretically at least, a person could have these plugs implanted and then 5 years later, when he wanted to start a family, have them removed. There are research done in primates that looked at 7 months after implantation, and they were able to get that out of the monkey vas deferens and restore the sperm count. It's always an event when we get a new form of contraception. I'm always excited about it anyway. The next thing that I want to do is just take an email, and then I'll be inviting your calls. This email is from Peggy in Salinas. Dear Dr. Don, I've been taking 250 milligrams of magnesium, 1 a day, for about a year, until 2 weeks ago when I was low and ordered more via mail. After about 5 days of not taking any magnesium, I started noting an aftertaste, something like the taste of after a filling at the dentist, a metallic type of taste. The only change I could think of was the stopping taking magnesium, no new toothpaste, no dental work, no dietary changes. And I've since started taking the magnesium, and the aftertaste is starting to go away. Could this food beverage aftertaste have been attributed to when I stopped taking magnesium? This is a 58-year-old woman, and she takes, let's see, vitamin C, fish oil, vitamin D3, red yeast rice, and CoQ10. And she parenthetically points out that the red yeast rice and CoQ10 has done great things for her bad cholesterols. So that's great, Peggy. I'm glad to hear that. Taste, and particularly metallic taste, always makes me wonder about zinc. I notice you're not taking a multivitamin. It crosses my mind that you may be zinc deficient and that the magnesium may somehow have been stabilizing that problem. When the magnesium was removed, the zinc deficiency sort of came to the fore and caused symptoms. So I think I would suggest adding a little zinc to your diet, perhaps 50 milligrams a day as a supplement, or maybe a multivitamin mineral supplement, and seeing if after a month or two and you stop the magnesium, whether that event recurs. That's all I've got for you today on that, but I'll be very interested in follow-up. Let me know if the zinc fixes the problem. We're going now to our first caller, and that is Ben in Watsonville. Hello, Ben, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Doctor. It's the prostate question in that 64 years of age. I don't think I have a problem, but it's about the information in that I know if you have problems urinating, it might lead to that, but I have no problems now. I was just thinking about the frequency. Is that related to any problems? I obviously drink a lot of liquids. Not obviously, but I do in the sense of water and when I work out and such. But I'm urinating maybe every 3 hours or so. And I'm wondering, is a full blood test, would that, any indicator on that let me know if I have problems on that? Or is the frequency of urination any problem?
Answer me one question, Ben. What about overnight? Do you have to get up more than once in the middle of the night to pee?
No, I'd say twice at the most.
Twice, okay. You know, a man in his 60s, that's not unusual or terribly worrisome. There is no blood test. We'd all love there to be a blood test that would say, yes, you have to worry about this prostate cancer, or no. We've got a very flawed test called a prostate-specific antigen, or PSA, that was originally developed to monitor existing cancers and see if they were coming back. We now misuse that test to screen for cancers, and it's not all that good a test for that purpose.
It's not adequate or beneficial?
It's flawed. You can argue, is it beneficial? It's a bit like the mammogram issue, you know, that was very much in the news the last couple of weeks.
Right.
Similar problem. If you do PSAs in younger men and they're elevated, you go on kind of a chase for cancers, and we haven't really been able to establish that early detection in those younger men with aggressive cancers actually is life-saving. But the trouble is our net, when we do PSA testing, catches a lot of fish who don't have cancer or who have a cancer which will never hurt them. And then, of course, once we found it, we feel obligated to treat. So there's a lot of unnecessary treatment generated by the testing. And it's a big argument, essentially, is should we test everybody? Should we not? What do we want to do with these results when they're borderline high? It's a mess. It's as simple as that. There's a lot of debate and no real clear path. In your case, I want to emphasize that regardless of what the blood test showed, it wouldn't tell us that your urination had anything to do with it. You probably have some mild enlargement of the prostate, not at all unusual in a male.
I had the finger test.
The finger test, the dreaded finger test, yes.
Right.
You know, every Halloween I get out a latex glove and snap it. And, you know, just because it's the scariest sound that a man can hear in the doctor's office.
Or the best one.
Yes, exactly. Aside from the sound of snapping latex, the thing I would say about a prostate exam is that's actually fairly accurate for identifying cancers because they unfortunately tend to cluster on the outside of the prostate, but it's not 100% itself either. If your prostate's slightly enlarged and you're bothered by the frequent urination, I recommend that you look into saw palmetto. You can often find that in combination with nettle. And both of these compounds are herbal products that tend to inhibit an enzyme that causes testosterone to turn into dihydrotestosterone, which is the form that causes the prostate to enlarge a little bit. So if you block that enzyme, you get less DHT in your body tissue, and the prostate doesn't enlarge anymore, because right now your symptoms are manageable, but if they get worse, they could be unpleasant. It also has some very, and I want to emphasize, very, very preliminary suggestion that it may be an anti-cancer herb, or it may reduce the frequency of prostate cancer over the very, very long term. That's preliminary data, and it's not established. So,
would that interfere with Coumadin if I'm taking that?
Coumadin interactions with saw palmetto, you probably, if you look it up, will see that it could interfere with Coumadin. My attitude on Coumadin is that everything interferes with Coumadin.
Right.
You know, your diet, phases of the moon, it's just really frustrating drug to have to work with, which is why we check blood levels. So for all of my patients on Coumadin, what I tell them is when you start a new herb, if you start a new vitamin, if your cardiologist puts you on a new drug, if your dermatologist puts you on a new drug, I don't care who or what, after about a week, check your INR, check your PT and your INR test, and make sure that you haven't either gone too far up or too far down and gotten out of your treatment range. And then be consistent. Take the pill. You may have to alter the Coumadin dose. If you're going to be on saw palmetto, fine, so be it. Alter the Coumadin dose, take the saw palmetto, and the monthly checks. I hope your doctor checks you monthly.
Yes.
So the monthly checks will turn up anything that's minor in terms of drift, but a check a week after starting a substance will show up anything major in terms of drift.
Okay, so usually the incontinence is usually related to prostate. In other words, if you have trouble urinating, it's more related to prostate trouble as opposed to having a natural flow, even though it's frequently. Is that correct?
I didn't catch the last part of that. Having a what kind of flow?
Well, in other words, if you're naturally, even if you're frequently urinating, the more related prostate trouble is incontinence and having trouble urinating, correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, prostates can cause a series of different symptoms. Frequency at night is one. Irritation, so you pee and then you don't feel like you finished peeing, so that feels like you're still full. Sometimes you actually are still full because you have what's called an outlet obstruction. The prostate's gotten so big that the bladder isn't emptying completely. That's where the incontinence typically associated with prostate comes from, is from incomplete emptying of the bladder. And then also people will sometimes have delay. So it'll take a while to get the stream started, and the stream will be really slow, so it takes a long time to drain the bladder. So there are lots of different manifestations that kind of fall under the heading of either obstructive symptoms or irritability symptoms.
And so in essence, anybody over 60, the frequent finger check once a year, and at this point, the PSA test.
Well, now we're talking about prostate cancer. You just switched topics on me. I don't know you realize that.
No, I didn't. I just wondered, staying on top of it.
Right. You're staying on top of prostate cancer surveillance with the PSA and the digital rectal exam. And what you've got otherwise is you've got a physiological state, not uncommon at your age, that can be annoying and affect your quality of life. So the treatment for that would be the saw palmetto and the nettle. And there are drugs, Flomax being, you know, the classic trade name. There's also a much cheaper generic form of Flomax that I generally steer my patients towards, because I don't feel like giving the pharmaceutical companies money for something that isn't any better than generic. You know, when they've got a drug that's better, great, I'm all for them. But there's a lot of things out there that are just, you know, quote unquote, new and improved toothpaste kind of things, where the old stuff does the job just fine. So talk to your doctor about that if you're concerned about these symptoms or they're getting in the way of your quality of life. Okay?
Okay.
All about quality.
I appreciate it. Great show. Thank you.
Thank you. My producer has just popped up on my screen the fact that, yes, indeed, saw palmetto can increase the effectiveness of the warfarin. So in other words, you'll get an increased risk of bleeding. So should you take them together? Like I said, monitor the INR. But I don't believe that just being on Coumadin is a reason to avoid taking all vitamins or avoid eating all vegetables or some of the other really extreme and self-serving bits of CYA advice that some of my patients have gotten from other physicians. Just don't agree with that. So let's take another email. This one is from Josh in London. Vitamin D may exacerbate autoimmune disease? ? Many health specialists, Dr. Don, have mentioned the numerous benefits of having optimized vitamin D levels, especially those with autoimmune disease. I note that you mentioned in your interview with Dr. Tom O'Brien that many of your patients suffering with autoimmune disease have been advised to take vitamin D supplements. My question is, anecdotally, have you noticed an improvement with these patients? Second, I found this article that you may have seen. We'll come to that in a moment. Do you think it is valid? It reminds me about H. pylori and peptic ulcer research, also from Australia. Josh, thank you very much for the letter. The question about noticing an improvement on patients who take vitamin D, yes, I have noticed an improvement in my autoimmune disease patients who are placed on vitamin D supplements. It's purely anecdotal. Obviously, I'm thinking that they probably will improve. I'm gratified when they do. And the improvement seems to be a reduction in the symptoms. The article that you mention is a paper that is published by a nonprofit called Autoimmunity Research Foundation, and it appeared in the journal Autoimmunity Reviews, and it is making the kind of contrarian argument, and it's a very interesting, provocative argument, that maybe vitamin D levels are low in people with autoimmune disease, not because the low vitamin D triggers or facilitates the autoimmune disease, but because the autoimmune disease triggers the low vitamin D. And the argument that the researchers make, and this is where the H. pylori thing comes in, is that autoimmune disease might be caused by persistent pathogens. In other words, bacteria in the intestine or bacteria elsewhere in the body that are causing the disease that we call autoimmune disease. And the researchers then go on to say that the vitamin D receptor is extremely important in the regulation of a lot of processes. It regulates at least 900 genes, and these control the innate immune response. They control the antimicrobial peptides and the things that are produced as part of the innate immune response. That's the natural killer cells, and the type of immunity that happens as soon as you're infected if you don't have an acquired immunity. So when you get a new infection, the situation, for example, when someone who is a naive flu patient gets exposed to H1N1 and contracts it and has not been vaccinated. The idea here is that taking high doses of 25-hydroxy vitamin D might downregulate the vitamin D receptor, and that this would downregulate the immune system, which in the short run would alleviate the autoimmune symptoms, so it would look like you were improving the patient, but in the long run might interfere with the body's ability to fight off these persistent pathogens and therefore lead to a long-term exacerbation of the cause of the autoimmune disease. And I think it's an interesting paper, but I believe that it completely misinterprets the existing data. And so I would say that a couple of things here that are plausible and testable and should be looked at. And one of the bits of research is the idea that if you take levels of 25-hydroxy vitamin D, let's say in the range of 2,000 to 5,000 units, that you're going to downregulate the vitamin D receptor with that. And I think that's an absolutely provable or testable hypothesis. If it's enough to downregulate the vitamin D receptor, then yes, further research should be done. I don't think that at this point, just because H. pylori causes ulcer disease, that we need to assume that all human disease is caused by bacteria again. I think we've got real clear evidence in terms of an alternative hypothesis for autoimmune disease, that the autoimmune disease causes, because the person has an autoimmune predisposition, they have a certain setting in their immune system at the get-go, the bacteria in their intestines are acting via the mechanism of molecular mimicry to cause this individual to make antibodies, that is to say, acquired immunity material, against self-tissue antigens. So it's a case of the Klebsiella bacteria has something on its surface that looks a lot like one of the tissue surface markers that people who have HLA-B27 have on their blood cell surfaces and the cells of their joints. Therefore, when you start making antibody against Klebsiella, because it's living in your intestines, then you start making antibody that can attack the joints of your spinal column, aggravating a condition that we call ankylosing spondylitis. In that instance, for example, a clear connection between the persistence of this bacteria in the colon and flare-ups of the disease. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the cause, that the Klebsiella is causing the disease. You have to get a little bit more sophisticated than these folks in Australia are. They're still back in the infectious disease model, and I think I'm here standing in the middle of the complex interacting feedback loop systems model and saying the data can be explained more adequately by the systems model than by this disease causality model from which they're proceeding. So, hope that wasn't too long-winded an answer, but it is an interesting issue. Let's move now to Alyssa in Aptos. Hello, Alyssa, and welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello.
I don't know where to begin. Painful urination, and the medication that I was taking was Vandazole.
I'm sorry, say that again?
Vandazole.
Vandazole. I've never heard of that.
Vaginal gel. I was just applying it on the outside.
Okay. Is it an over-the-counter product? Did you buy it with a prescription or without a prescription?
With a prescription.
Okay. Well, it's probably a drug that I've heard of under a name that I haven't. But the azole part suggests to me that it's probably an antifungal medication. So what was your question about that?
Well, whether I'm supposed to, or is it all right to eat eggs? Is it
all right to eat eggs? Yes. If you're not allergic to eggs, there's no drug that I can think of that interacts with eggs in terms of diet. So I can't think of a single thing that you couldn't eat eggs with. So I think with confidence, not even knowing what the drug is, I could say that it's okay to eat eggs unless there's some other reason you shouldn't. Is that helpful for you?
Yes. I also have painful urination.
Uh-huh. Now, is it painful like a burning only when you pee?
Yes.
And when you're not urinating, is there any pain above the pubic bone or any feeling like you have to urinate frequently?
No.
Okay. So I want you to try an experiment for me. Then this will tell us whether or not you need to have your urine checked, okay, to see if you have a bladder infection. And it's really simple, kind of gross, but you'll do it, you know, just once. You put about 2 inches of water in the bathtub so that you're sitting down in the bathtub and make sure that your privates are covered by the water and then urinate. And basically, into the water, yes. So you're underwater and you urinate underwater. And if it's painful down there because you've got a raw yoni, like the outside part of your vagina is irritated from a yeast infection or from a reaction to the medication, possibly. Either way, if it'll isolate whether the pain is coming from the outside part or the inside part. If it's coming from inside the urethra, then when you sit in the water and pee, it'll still burn because it's the urethra that's being burned by the urine. And so it'll help you decide whether you need to go back to the doctor and get checked for a bladder infection. Does that make sense to you?
Yes.
Good. Okay. So I would start out with that. Now, if it burns when you pee and you're sitting in the water, then you have to go back to the doctor.
And underwater.
If it burns when you pee.
Underwater.
Underwater, then you might have a bladder infection as opposed to a vaginal infection. Now, it looks like Vandazole is actually an antibiotic, so it's possible that the doctor thought that you had a bacterial infection of the vagina. And that certainly can happen. It's very difficult to tell the difference between the two. And both of them can cause a lot of irritation. But if your cream doesn't improve the situation very rapidly, within 3 or 4 days, then we need to think about other possibilities. Okay?
Yes.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Good luck
Bye-bye.
To you.
Wanted
to talk a little bit about, I'm going to call it our science lesson of the week. This is about grapefruit juice. We hear all the time about drug-food interactions, and we've had a couple of discussions come up even today about drug-food and drug-herb interactions. So I thought I would pull this out of the Anytime file and go over it with you. For those of you who are physicians or other types of health professionals or who just have a sophisticated interest in science, I want to point you to a website that I was recently turned on to called fpnotebook.com. And this appears to be a physician who probably might have a little OCD going on, but God bless the mild OCDs when they actually write their stuff down because it's usually very well coordinated and outlined and they actually get completion. And this doctor's been kind enough to share with us his notebooks that he refers to in his profession as a doctor. And they're wonderful. Lots of good information here, well-supported documentation and references attached, which is lovely. We're going to talk about the grapefruit drug interaction, and I'm pulling this information from the fpnotebook.com. Now, first of all, we've talked, and certainly any regular listener is aware of these things called cytochrome P450 enzymes, which break down substances, whether they be drugs, herbs, or foods. Just about everything has to pass through one or a series of cytochromes in order to be metabolized. So the effect of grapefruit juice actually is not in the liver, it's in the intestine. And what it does in the intestine is inhibit intestinal cytochrome P450 3A4. And 3A4 is a big enzyme. It metabolizes a lot of drugs, including immune modulators like cyclosporin and tacrolimus, and a lot of the HIV antiviral drugs. Within 4 hours of taking grapefruit or grapefruit juice, cytochrome P450 3A4 in the intestine is decreased, and that decrease may persist for up to 72 hours. As a result, you will actually get more drug being absorbed. The drug isn't being broken down in the intestine, so it's intact to be absorbed. Drugs like amiodarone and quinidine, which are common antiarrhythmics, are affected by this. A lot of blood pressure medications like Procardia, which is nifedipine, are affected. And yet other drugs in the same group are not. So there's no rule here. You actually have to go looking it up. In case of statins, both Lipitor and Simvastatin or Zocor are affected and therefore have an increased effect in the body, whereas drugs like Lescal, Pravacol, and Crestor are not affected because they're metabolized differently by the body. I already mentioned HIV drugs, and the important thing here is to understand that if you're taking grapefruit juice on a regular basis, then you will have a increased serum concentration of the drugs. And as long as your doctor knows that you're doing the grapefruit, it's just like the situation with the Coumadin, you probably should be consistent about it so that the drug can be titrated against the grapefruit use. If you are a person who goes on and off these drugs, or if you are taking a drug who's got a narrow therapeutic range, that is to say too much would be bad, and there is no way to monitor blood levels, then this might be one where you should actually stay away from the grapefruit. The important thing to understand here is that these interactions vary quite a bit. While they may exist at a certain level for the general population, there will be individuals, perhaps 1 to 2 people out of 100, who because of a difference in the actual structure of their cytochrome 3A4 may be either invincible and invulnerable to this effect, or on the contrary, highly sensitive to this effect, so that they would have a really extreme amplification of blood levels. And the problem is, we don't know who you are. So when one deals with drug-food interactions, drug-herb interactions, or drug-drug interactions, the important advice that I can give you as a patient or as a fellow practitioner is be open to the possibility of these interactions. Look for them if something unusual or unexplainable is happening, and be prepared, if you are needing to troubleshoot, to look at one of these tables and find a different drug in the class of drugs, so calcium channel blockers, for example. Instead of using nifedipine, switch to verapamil, which is not affected by that same enzyme pathway, and see if you get a better clinical result. This was off air. Is eating grapefruit the same risk as grapefruit juice regarding the drug interactions? And the answer to that is yes, absolutely. Same discussion for grapefruit or grapefruit juice. This from Jocelyn in Santa Cruz. Jocelyn says, I've listened to you discuss the danger of plastic bottles and how hormone mimic molecules enter the body. What about the impact of boys drinking sodas and water in plastic before and during puberty? Well, Jocelyn, definitely think there could be a potential impact. I'm even more worried about their mothers drinking water in plastic bottles and otherwise encountering these hormone mimics during pregnancy, because it's clear that in utero is when you are the most vulnerable here. But there are a lot of studies looking at bisphenol A, which is, I think, a truly bad actor in the range of hormone disruptors, and diabetes and metabolic syndrome. So one of my concerns is that boys who are drinking, especially if they're drinking lots of soda with high fructose corn syrup in it, is that they may actually be increasing their risk of developing diabetes. And that's just no good anywhere. The other thing that has been seen in laboratory animals, given doses of BPA, which are, in terms of what blood level you're going to achieve in the rat, commensurate with the highest quartile of blood levels that we see when we go out and just test random members of the population, the highest 25% group that we can find in people, as far as blood levels are concerned, in rats that get that concentration in their blood, there is a lowered sperm count. So quite some concern that fertility could be affected. And obviously, that's a big, big deal. One last email, this one from Wesley in Santa Cruz. Night sweats and lymphoma. I'm 31 years old, athletic, healthy boy, well-balanced eater. My question's about night sweats and the supposed signs of lymphoma. Poor Wesley's been on the internet. I've had these night sweats, which seem to be getting progressively worse. I've searched for possible remedies and was startled to find a connection with lymphoma. I'm not a hypochondriac, but I was surprised to relate so many of the symptoms, loss of energy, weight imbalance, and itchy skin. My weight's 185 and I have to eat a lot to maintain it. I'm eating about every 3 hours. Mostly I'm eating fruits that are non-allergic. My question is, how is lymphoma test performed? Is it invasive? And how much would it cost to a non-insured patient? Folks, let me give you some advice. If you don't have health insurance, never, never, never Google your symptoms. Never go online searching for whatever symptom you've got, because you will get a whole list of horrific things that will severely and negatively impact your quality of life. And if you don't have health insurance, you're not going to be able to get rid of the ghost that you just taunted yourself with. So never seek a diagnosis by symptoms. This is something we all learn in the first year of medical school when we start doing it and we freak out and think we've got all these diseases. Oh, I have abdominal bloating. Oh my God, I've got ovarian cancer. It's just a head trip you don't want to do. There's lots of things that cause night sweats. Sure, lymphoma, leukemia, tuberculosis, those are up there on the list. But how about this? How about anxiety? That'll also cause night sweats. Simple medical workups, some blood tests, Wesley. If you'd put a PPD, which is a TB test, on, you'd check liver enzymes, a blood count, a sed rate, and you'd have a doctor go over and feel all of your lymph nodes. Now, if all of those tests were negative, normal sed rate, normal liver enzymes, no elevation in the lactate dehydrogenase, and you don't have any swollen lymph nodes, the probability of your night sweats being related to lymphoma is still not zero, but it's low enough that you don't need to get the total body CT scan, which for many reasons I would discourage. However, like I said, my best advice to all of you is don't Google your symptom. Let's go to Jim in Felton. Hello, Jim. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you. I'm calling about, with a question in general about vitiligo.
Uh-huh.
And I really just wonder if there, is it true that there's really no treatment?
Well, the treatment for vitiligo is in debate, okay? Some doctors have been able, by injecting cortisone into the fading patches. Vitiligo, folks, is where you lose pigment in the skin. And it's blotchy and you start looking like a kind of like a calico cat. In severe cases, people have taken to bleaching their skin in order to even things out because of the really negative appearance, the spottiness that they get from the vitiligo. When we talk about treatment, some doctors have done intralesional steroid injections, and that can work. I've read a really interesting paper where they used poison oak toxin, and they basically gave people poison oak on their vitiligo. And of course, they got a rash. They got a poison oak rash. It only worked in people who were poison oak sensitive. And then as the poison oak rash healed, there was improvement of the vitiligo. And presumably what happens is that you create an inflammation, an immunity storm, in other words, by the allergic reaction that people have to the poison oak. And then the feedback mechanisms kick in and back off the allergic reaction, and also, not coincidentally, back off the vitiligo, which is also an immune reaction, but it's immune reaction against self.
Would that be temporary?
Good question. I don't really know what the long-term follow-up was on those lesions or whether they recurred. With that in mind, people have started using other forms of irritants to the vitiligo to see if that's effective. So I wouldn't say that it's without treatment. I would say that treatment results are variable. I certainly would encourage you to check a vitamin D level. I know vitamin D a lot today, but check a blood level for your vitamin D, because I do believe that any kind of autoimmune disease should be evaluated with respect to vitamin D levels. And I also wonder, is there any history of low thyroid in the family or other autoimmune diseases?
Oh, thank you.
Just an association to think about. So hope that was helpful for you, and thanks for the call.
So. Thank you, Dr. Don.
Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Let's talk to Leslie in San Jose. Hello, Leslie. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Don. Three questions. One, I wanted you to talk about two things that I'm doing that I'm having dramatic results with. Coconut oil and chia seeds.
Okay.
Do you know anything about what those things are?
Well, I know what they are, but what are you treating?
Chia seeds is giving me fantastic results with constipation.
Okay, probably a fiber effect. The chia seeds, just like flax seeds, have lots and lots of lignans in them, which are a form of soluble fiber.
Okay.
The other good thing about lignans is that they are food for good bacteria. So if you eat a lot of them, your good bacteria counts, colony counts will go up, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's protective.
Okay.
And with respect to the coconut oil, are you also doing that for constipation?
I'm doing that because it's something special about it.
It contains some essential fatty acids.
Yeah, but one of the essential fatty acids that we don't make, I think, correct?
Right. Well, that's why they're essential.
Yeah.
Is because we don't make them. Yeah, coconut oil is a good source of essential fatty acids. It's high in omega-6 fatty acids. Usually it's gamma-linolenic acid that you're getting from the, I think, from coconut oil. I know that's what's in borage and some of the other things, evening primrose, and those substances are all omega-6 sources. Stay tuned on the subject of the omega-6s, because we have two classes there. We have the sort of saturated, like sunflower oil and safflower oil, and the things that we've really increased in our diet.
Right.
Since we got hydraulic presses and started squeezing these seeds to get oil out of them, they've become a really large part of the diet, and you'll see discussions of what the diet was like in terms of omega-3 and omega-6 ratios when we were cavemen or when we were hunter-gatherers, even after agriculture, but before the event of the hydraulic oil press.
Oh.
And they say that, oh, well, it was maybe 1-to-1 or maybe 2 times as much omega-6 as omega-3.
Okay.
And now we're at a ratio in the standard American diet of about 30-to-1. And just about everybody agrees that 30-to-1 is probably pushing it for our systems. And it's considered pro-inflammatory at that level. So the idea is that these omega-6s get turned into prostaglandins, which are really powerful and make you ache and make you hurt and are inflammatory. And if you use omega-3s to make the prostaglandins, they're not as inflammatory. They're more balanced, and the cell membranes are more fluid, so supposedly your neurotransmitters work better. And there's all sorts of arguments about this, and lots of science, and taking the basic science and applying it clinically, that's very much in flux right now. Okay, but I do think that if you're going to be taking large doses of fish oil, balancing it with some coconut oil or some walnut oil or one of these that contains the omega-6s is not such a bad idea. And I have to say that oil has gotten a bad name in our culture in the last 30 years or so because of the emphasis on heart disease prevention.
Right.
And yeah, that was a really good thing to try to emphasize to prevent, but avoiding all oil doesn't work. Substituting these healthy oils for the less healthy oils and the more inflammatory oils does seem to work. And so that's nothing wrong with your coconut oil, as long as you keep it balanced. And by the way, frying food in coconut oil, if you don't mind the taste, in moderation is not such a bad thing to do.
Okay. And in terms of consistency of the chia seeds, is there any chance that I could taking a scoopful a day? I mean, is that okay to do over a long period of time? Or, you know, because it seems like I'm pretty dependent on having a good movement after ingesting the chia seeds. Is there any problem with that, do you think?
Not that I know of, but I will double check. Are you a regular listener?
I certainly am. And Guess what? I'm in close to Santa Clara and I'm getting you, so that's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. I'm glad to hear that.
For all you San Jose listeners.
What station are you listening to?
I'm listening to KUSP, but the numbers are 90.3 in San Jose.
Right. It's redistributed on a different transmitter. Thank you. Knowing it's 90.3, that was my question. I want to mention, I had that wrong, it's linoleic acid, is not linolenic acid. So
lenic is the 3, I think, right?
Lenic is the 3 and leic is the 6, and I have a real hard time keeping that straight. So fortunately, I've got my producer there actually listening to it for an hour a day. My producer listens to what I say. No, I'm teasing.
We know about your producer. Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Yeah. And a thanks from the heart to my producer, Charles Mansky. He's also responsible for doing all of the production on the website and making this whole thing possible. So the unsung hero of Ask Dr. Don. I think the other big story of the week was the CT scan story. So published 2 different studies in the Archives of Internal Medicine looking at increased cancer risk for people who have had a CT scan, excess cancer risk. Now, the problem with this study is what we call a problem in attributable risk, because obviously if you've had a CT scan, you've had a symptom, you've had a issue, you've had a medical reason that you had the CT scan, rather than the CT scans causing cancer, some of the cancers may have caused the CT scan. So you're not dealing with an entirely clean baseline bit of data here. And the authors really don't discuss that. The assumptions here in the statistical analysis are that people get CT scans randomly and that there's no selection of the group that would cause the group that gets CT scans to have a higher baseline cancer risk. And I don't think you can necessarily make that assumption. So the data is a little suspect from that basis. But the thing that I found most astonishing from this study was not necessarily the fact that a CT scan of any kind, but particularly ones where there are more complex studies done or angiography done, has a lot of radiation attached. We knew that. But the amount of radiation for the same scan actually varies by more than an order of magnitude. In other words, more than tenfold from institution to institution based on arbitrary criteria which are established by the manufacturer and by the institution in terms of where they dial the dial. So what we need to do in response to this article is not stop getting CT scans. But what we do need to do is think twice and only order a CT scan when it's going to change the management of the patient. And that's the take-home message for doctors. The take-home message for hospitals and other institutions that do CT scans is get your act together and use the lowest possible dose of radiation and be prepared to prove it. Start noting the radiation settings on the scans as they're done. Make that part of the permanent record so that in 5 or 10 years, we can go back and we can optimize our scan settings and systematize that people receive the lowest possible radiation dose when they have a necessary scan. And indeed, many of these scans are necessary and life-saving, and many of them are just hand-holding that can be done without. So we need to sort that one out too. But altogether, very interesting to see the great variability in the power settings that are used for the same scan. And that's a problem that can be solved, well, very quickly, with just some collaboration and some cooperation on the part of the institutions. Let's go to Judy in Bonnie Doon.
Hi, thank you. I've talked to you before, and this is a cholesterol question.
Okay.
I had a high cholesterol read in March. Trying to find the test online. It looked like it was 326 was the cholesterol total. And then I started on the red rice yeast and also milk thistle to protect my liver, and I got it down, it looks like 30 points. Had another test, and it showed 291.
Is that cholesterol or LDL?
That's cholesterol.
Okay, what's your LDL now?
Here we are. The LDL now calculated 171.
Okay, couple of thoughts. One of which is, be sure you're taking CoQ10. At least 150 milligrams a day because you are on a statin, whether you realize it or not.
Mm-hmm. I think the red yeast rice that I take has the CoQ10 in it.
Make sure.
110 milligrams, did you say?
150 would be
150.
Good.
So
yeah. Make
might not be that high.
Make sure it does. That would be the dose I would recommend. The other thing is that I would ask for a VAP, which is a test where they don't just calculate your LDL, they actually measure it, and it will also give us particle size.
VAP?
V as in Victor, yes.
Oh, V.
That test will measure the particle size. Berkeley Heart Lab does it, Quest does it, I'm sure you can get it through PAMF. And what you're looking for is particle size on your LDL. If you have a 171 and it's pattern A and a decent level of HDL such that your total cholesterol divided by your HDL is under 4 at this time, and you don't have elevated hsCRP, which is the C-reactive protein. So there's a bunch of conditions there. You can go back and listen to this to hear them again. But if normal hsCRP, the total cholesterol divided by the HDL is under 4, and you have, of your 171 particles, they are a type A or a pattern A, which means big fluffy particles, then you're in pretty good shape from a cardiac disease risk standpoint.
Okay.
Okay. If your doctor may be pushing to take a higher dose to try to get the LDL under 130, and if the particles are small, if they're pattern B, I would encourage that.
Okay.
But if they're pattern A, and you're, given you're female and you meet those other criteria, I don't necessarily think there's enough data to say that you're going to have additional benefit by going on to a stronger medication such as a statin.
Could you also increase by increasing the dose of the red yeast rice, or would you, if it is bad, thinking you should get on to the statins, which is what I thought red yeast rice basically is?
It is a weak form of statin, yes. Uh-huh. It's a weak form of lovastatin, almost identical, or if not completely identical molecule.
I guess that was kind of, ultimately, I will try and see if I can get this VAP test done.
I'm sure they'll do it. It's not an expensive test.
Okay, but my bigger question is, you know, how long do I keep taking the red rice yeast if I lowered it? Do I keep taking it longer to lower it further? Do I add Hawthorne, which was a recommendation of another?
If you add Hawthorne, it'll improve your heart. It's good for the blood vessels. It's good for cardiac functioning. It doesn't directly lower cholesterol. So
okay.
It's going at it from a different angle.
Mm-hmm.
It's good for heart health, but not the same thing.
Okay.
Do you do that or do you not do it? I guess it rather depends on whether you have got a disease or you're trying to prevent a disease.
And well, I've got a dad who finally died of congestive heart failure, so I think I'm pretty prone to the genetic side of all this. So
no,
I've been...
that doesn't follow at all.
Oh,
no.
Doesn't?
Nope, doesn't follow at all.
Okay.
It depends on why your father had congestive heart failure. But
yeah.
Basically, people, when I ask, is there a family history of heart disease, and someone says, oh yeah, my mother has mitral valve prolapse, that's not a heart attack risk factor, and neither is congestive heart failure.
Mm-hmm.
If your father had congestive heart failure, it could have been because he had uncontrolled hypertension for 50 years.
He had high cholesterol.
Doesn't matter.
Oh.
That high cholesterol only causes congestive heart failure after it gives you a heart attack. I will tell you something. There is reason to believe that high doses of statin over a long time may actually contribute to congestive heart failure.
Uh-huh.
So we have to be really careful that we don't create more heart failure. And that's why the CoQ10 is so important.
Okay. But once you're taking this to lower your HDLs, do you take it forever?
Well, let me put it this way. If you make soup according to a recipe, you will always put a tablespoon of salt in it for 2 teaspoons of salt for a big pot of soup.
Right.
That's how you make the soup. If you decide next week to make the soup without the salt, it's going to taste different. Well, the soup is your blood, and the salt is your red rice yeast. So if you stop taking it, you're going to have a different soup, which means probably that your cholesterol will revert back up.
Uh-huh.
You're altering your physiology, your natural physiology, with the drug. When you stop altering it, it'll bounce back to its previous pattern, unless you've made some other change in your diet or your exercise that causes it not to bounce back.
Yeah. I feel like I've had a really good diet and exercise all these years, and I was surprised
well,
to have this test.
When you look at lipids, it's really important to understand that they are a statistical risk factor. They're not a disease.
Right.
And having high cholesterol doesn't mean you will ever get heart disease. It's a risk factor.
Okay.
But it isn't fully predictive, and people make that mistake.
Yeah, they make a big deal of it, like it's you have this, and you're going to have clogged arteries, and you're going to have a heart attack.
Right. That's not true, but it's statistically true. But it's not true necessarily for any given individual.
Right.
And the trick is to understand that people have a real desire as physicians to do something.
Uh-huh.
You remember the phrase, don't just stand there, do something?
Right.
Well, I have a little mantra that I say to myself frequently, which is don't just do something, stand there.
Right.
Because what we need to do is kind of support the organism and do everything in context of the individual instead of going, oh, here's the algorithm, here's this think tank's table, and your number is such and such, and you have 2 risk factors, therefore you need to do this.
Yeah.
That applies to the group. It'll be good for 70%, which means it'll be bad for 30%.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we have to wrap this up, but
okay.
Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you very much for the information. I'll get that VAP test and see what happens.
Very good.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, we've come to the end of another hour, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. You can listen to this program again or listen to previous programs at AskDrDawn.com. You can also check out the archives of interviews and previous programs. I hope that you will find that website a resource, and I'm always open to suggestions about how my producer, who does all the work, can make that a better resource for you. So this is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.